Here we go. Okay. Getting a lot of questions here. This is the fun part. Now you know all the pharmacology that there is to know. So we're at the end of the year. You've had all your clinical training. You're out in the real world. You're getting ready to write prescriptions. What do you need to know? Well, you got to choose the appropriate drug. So, you know, as the competencies go, you're going to use science to guide diagnosis and treatment and things of that nature. So you're going to fall back on all this knowledge that you've pumped into your brain. And then what are you going to do with it? You're going to probably write a prescription, and it's probably going to look like that. Who's the patient? Okay, don't worry about the patient. What's the drug?
500 milligrams.
Okay, so 500 milligrams of something. Oh, you can recognize Vicodin. Okay, so let's go back here. So what is it? It's hydrocodone plus ACP. What's ACP? Acetaminophen. The 500 refers to the amount of acetaminophen that's there. So it's Vicodin. Okay. What does this say?
Take,
okay. Take as needed for pain. Okay. Now, that's a well-written prescription. Okay. My wife gave me several to choose from. No, this one's not, but Joe Neer wrote this one, and he wrote it in his normal scrawl. Joe's handwriting's illegible most of the time. But the point's the same. You need to be an effective communicator with the pharmacy. The pharmacy is going to give the drug to the patient. So is it fair to ask the pharmacist to ask the patient what the drug's for so that they understand what the drug is? Not really. So you need to think about, you know, how you write your scripts. Yes, if you scribble, you can get it written more quickly. But is that the best thing for the patient? So things like this signature down here, can that be totally illegible? Probably. That's not the most important thing, because they'll, you know, your name's on the script, right? So, and the patient knows who they saw, so, but this is really important. So the instructions are very important. Sometimes docs do even stranger things. They'll write a script for something that's has to be compounded, has to be prepared. There is, for example, if you have nail fungal infections, they're very difficult to treat. Typically, you would take Lamisil, which is an antifungal. You would take it for 84 days orally. It's really expensive stuff until the generic came out this year. But you can also get Lamisil and tea tree oil and DMSO, except it's not Lamisil. It's ketoconazole, which is a different brand name. But everybody recognizes it as an antifungal solution. But it's actually mislabeled because it's got the wrong drug in it. And yet, there's a doc in town that writes this stuff all the time for his patients. Now, the good news is that the pharmacy knows what he wants, and so they can provide the patient with what the doc's trying to give them. But I imagine the first time that script showed up, they had no clue. Because it turns out it's a pretty complicated process. It's got ketoconazole in it. It's got DMSO. It's got cetyl alcohol. It's got water. It's got ibuprofen. It's got, what's missing? Tea tree oil. Now, I'm not going to tell you what the recipe is for this, but it doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to realize that that's fairly complicated. Compounding it is actually fairly simple once you got the recipe, because it all goes into a nice liquid and it stays there. But if you don't communicate well with the pharmacy is going to do what? They're going to call you. Okay? Should you get mad at the messenger who's calling you and saying, I can't read your prescription? It's really not a good idea. Now, a lot of times, practices can actually do this. Now, if you go into Southern Indiana Pediatrics, this isn't typed, obviously, but they'll have the body filled out. And they'll check if it's available in multiple concentrations, they'll check which dosage is the one that they want to give. And so, especially for a number of the antibiotics that they use all the time. So you can have pre-printed things. Now, this happens to be a SCED 2, so you get into different issues with scheduled drugs. But the point is that if you get into a practice situation where you can do some standardization, that's not a bad way to go. Don't do it for a scheduled drug, though. Bad idea. Somebody will steal your scripts. And all you do is hit the button and the EMR faxes it to the pharmacy. Really cool. Until the phone lines get messed up. Or the fax machine screws up or something like that. But if you're going by the old-fashioned prescription, make sure that the labeling, that the writing is legible. It's one test of your communication ability. Now, one of the things you'll notice on these two different scripts is these SIG lines, okay, signature lines. On the left-hand side is dispenses written. On the right-hand side is may substitute. What in the world are we talking about? Generic versus brand name. Which state is the only state in the union that does this? Indiana. Okay? So it's kind of crazy. One of the things that will help is if you've got a particular attitude and you let all the pharmacies where you're practicing know that attitude, then they won't have to call you back and say, what did you want? When they're confused. Most of the IMA docs, for example, if you work for IMA, then you can sign it over here, but if a generic is available, it'll get substituted. Because they know that IMA will sanction and allow generic substitution. But if your practice doesn't do that, or if you really want it over here, what are you doing when you sign on the left? You're basically saying that I want Vicodin. I don't want some generic house compound. I want the brand name drug. There are patients out there who think that only the brand name works for them. That may be true. It may not be. But when you sign on the left, what do you have to have up here? You have to have the brand name. If you don't have the brand name, then this is meaningless. In fact, one might argue you're showing your ignorance of the pharmacy law, which you shouldn't be ignorant of. So if you're going to sign on the left, you better use the brand name. If you write the brand name and you sign over here, then you're saying that if there's a generic available, patient wants it, that's fine with me. One thing that happens quite a bit, people will write the generic, they'll sign over on the right, and the patient will say, but the generic doesn't work for me. I have to have the brand name. Where is this most common? This drug right here. And why is that? If you're selling it on the street, this is the stuff that makes the bucks. So with your abused drugs especially, people will come in and they'll just swear up and down that it's got to be the brand name, and you have to sign on the left as the doctor. And they know the pharmacy law. And they will tell you, you didn't sign on the left like you were supposed to. That should be a huge flag that this patient doesn't need this. This patient wants this for an alternative purpose. So just think about it. When you're choosing a drug and you write the generic name, you really should be signing on the right-hand side. If you write the brand name and you don't care if it's brand or generic, you sign on the right. If there's no generic available, the patient will get the brand name. So it's not something that you have to worry about. If you want the brand name, though, and you do not want substitution, then you have to sign on the left. Yes?
So for
this prescription, if you wrote this and you signed over here, the patient would get a generic. Because most likely the insurance company won't pay for this one. What? How does it work? All states have formularies. And so if you're dealing with especially Medicaid type patients, you don't have any choice. You're going to be using the agent off the formulary. So that's one, another twist in the process. If you want it in most of the other states, you would only write this. You'd only write the brand name. But then the patient has the choice, or the insurance company would dictate the choice. So it's really, when you've got a generic available, everybody's going to push the generic. Okay. So generics. People often ask, you know, is it, wait a minute, where's my sheet? Here we go. You don't have this because you don't need to write all this stuff down. But I went and looked at an FDA website and pulled this off of it. What are generic drugs? Okay. Generic products have to be approved as safe and effective. They have to contain identical amounts of the same active drug in the same dosage form for that route of administration. They have to meet the same standards of strength, quality, purity, and identity as the brand name product. They are bioequivalent. So these are what is required. So going generic is pretty simple, really. And with a lot of compounds, there's a huge variation in the things that go along with the active agent in the capsule or the tablet. But they have to meet these guidelines. So case in point, are generics bad? There's a huge industry out there, and what will happen is the industry will find out if the generic is bad, and it'll get yanked off the market pretty fast. So there may be a time window when there's a new product that's gone generic, and the patient might try it, and there may be a history of it's really not working. Pharmacies will drop it like a lead balloon because they don't want patients complaining to them that the drug's not working. So there's a huge scrutiny on the generic houses, and the fly-by-night cheaters and quackers have kind of been railroaded out by quality companies that are making good products. Okay, so those are the things that are required by a generic drug. Another thing that is important to think about is when you're communicating with the pharmacy, how do you minimize the potential for error? Now, this happens to have come from Riley. So there's a set of requirements. At Riley, they want the full generic name. This is not in your handout because I don't expect you to memorize all this. It's not time yet for that. They want the dose. They want it written in the appropriate units. Use zeros before a decimal point. Okay? Avoid trailing zeros. Trying to keep it clean. Don't use slashes, NPH slash 10 units, because that can be confusing. For adults, write the total dose. For pediatrics, you got the dose per kilogram and the total dose. And if you're doing chemotherapy, there are additional details that they want. You need to write the concentration, the route of administration, frequency of administration, and then they want to know date and time the order was written, and they want a full signature, first and last name. Use a ballpoint pen rather than a felt tip. What happens to a felt tip when you get sweaty hands on the top of it? So all of these goals are aimed at effective communication between the physician and the pharmacy. So different places are going to have different requirements. This just happens to be from Riley. When you write a prescription, and we're going to have a prescription on the exam, this prescription is not legal. What's missing? Don't worry about this. Sorry. But because you're not, what's missing up here? Quantity. Okay. Take as needed for pain. Okay. It's a loose script. But the pharmacy can't give anything out because it doesn't know what to give. So you've told it what you want. You want the 500 milligram tablet. So they know what you want. Now, how many do you want to give? You're going to give 10? So you got to indicate quantity. So you got the number sign and then some number beside it. So you need to indicate quantity. Refill. This says refill 2 times. That's really generous with this drug. What are the advantages when trying a new drug out of giving no refills, circling NR? So they'll call you and talk about it, or you can get them back into the office to evaluate them if there's something objective that you want to measure. So you just put them on an antihypertensive drug and you want to know if their blood pressure is coming down. You ask them to keep a blood pressure diary, but you want them to come into the office and have the nurse take the pressure too. No refills, you'll probably get them back. You can give up to a year. Some mail order can take 3-month supplies. Insurance will allow you to do that. So you can give a 3-month quantity with 4 refills and you got a year of drug. So by playing with the quantity and by playing with the number of refills, with birth control meds, you're giving them a month supply, but you're giving them 12 refills. So same sort of thing. You can play around with that. Okay, something else I should say. Any questions on all this? I didn't give you all these details as in the handout because I didn't think you needed to memorize it. But when you go to write a script, what do you need? Name, dosage, quantity, how to take it. You can indicate how many times per day by doing that, and the number of dots is how many doses per day. They're shorthand's not a good idea in a lot of places.
They usually write that, and then like TID.
What's TID mean?
Well, like
3 times a day. BID twice a day. QID 4 times a day. QD once a day. You can use Latin if you want to. The abbreviations I do not think are in your book. I can give you a handout that has a lot of that stuff on it if you want it. That's really the push in the industry. Because if you write it out, there's no question. If you use a symbol and you use a flare tip pen and it's a hot, humid day and the guy's sweating, what happens? It gets smeared, you don't know what you got. And you're going to get a phone call back. You're busy, the pharmacist is busy, and the patient's already impatient because they've waited in your office and now they're waiting in the pharmacy. Not a pretty combination. So the least confusion, the best. Okay, let's see. What else we got in here? Okay. So you need your name, address, phone number, license number, DEA numbers, what drug, what dose, what schedule for dosing, how many, and how many refills. Sometimes there are warnings that are get placed on the prescription bottles. Some docs don't like some of the warnings because they don't feel that they're necessary and don't want them on there. And you don't normally put that on the prescription, but that information would be communicated to the pharmacy just kind of as a general. For example, anytime tetracyclines are prescribed, you usually get the warning, avoid sun exposure. With some of your first generation antihistamines, they're highly sedating. The warning of, don't drive and don't operate heavy machinery is often put on there. With some drugs, ciprofloxacin or Cipro is one, it has a tendency to kind of precipitate out. It can cause some renal problems. You're supposed to take it with water to help make sure the kidney function stays like it's supposed to. That might be indicated. So there are a lot of different warnings that can go on there. Most of the time, you're not even going to think about them. It'll just be an automatic thing. But legally, the communication between you and the pharmacy requires the name of the drug, the dose, the dosage schedule, the quantity, and how many refills you want. Okay, off-label. Off-label is kind of interesting. Many people wonder if it's safe, should I do it? What are the pros and cons of off-label usage? Typically, when a drug has gone through this kind of testing, there's a tremendous volume of data available. Sometimes the data is crystal clear. Blood pressure drops. Hey, we got a new antihypertensive agent. But the patients that you studied may have been wearing, say, Holter monitors. And you've got heart rate, EKG, you got all kinds of data on them. And you look at the data and you think, well, the data's not too bad, but I'm not sure the FDA will give us, I'm not sure we've proven efficacy as an antiarrhythmic drug. But the word gets out that this compound, you publish a paper and it goes through the peer review process, it gets out into the literature and you find out, okay, it looks like it's got anti arrhythmic properties as well. So you decide, hey, I want to try it. So you write it. The insurance company is not going to know what it's written for. You're just putting this patient on this drug. So if it's for an off-label use, it's no big deal. No one's really going to know. But how do you protect yourself? If it's an off-label use, in theory, you're not using it properly. But if in your community the standard of care has become, this drug is great, let's use it, then you can always fall back on the argument that this has become standard of care in my locale. So it's a way of covering yourself if you want to try something that's different. Would others do the same? Would that be considered standard of care? Okay. Sources of information. There's data everywhere. There's the package insert. Now, when a company writes the package insert, who wrote it? So you had a professional writer. They started with scientific data, and they wrote it up, and then the legal department and the marketing people got editing rights. So ultimately, the product insert then has some potential for bias. It may have a lot of bias in it. It may not have much at all. It's going to depend on compounds and how good the data are and things of that nature. But recognize that the product insert is a function of the company, and so there is potential for bias in it. Printed reference books and journals. You can always go to places like PubMed. You can get on the IU system and go through Ovid if you want to search the literature to find out all you want to know about some drug. And then you can sit down and read all that literature in your spare time. It's a lot of work. So what happens? You tend to read review articles. You tend to go to CME courses and things like that. Are there potential pitfalls with those things? Yeah, there are. Are they going to be deliberate cover-ups? Minimally. Just bear in mind that it's your license. So if you want to do something, that's your privilege. But you can have the privilege taken away from you. So if you're going to do something off-label, if you're going to try something crazy, you know, make sure you got as much scientific data behind your decision as you can gather, because that will help support that decision. So you can use printed reference books and journals, CME seminars. If you talk to a member's representative, drug rep comes in, knocks on your door and asks for 10 minutes of your time. Brings lunch, brings donuts, whatever. Okay. You got to be careful, though, because they'll usurp as much time as you let them have. So if you don't mind devoting a fair amount of time to talking with drug reps, that's fine. But your office is open, your personnel are there, and you're paying them. So you need to think about that. But when a manufacturer's representative comes into your office, what is their job?
To sell their drug.
To sell their drug. So just remember, there's going to be potential for bias there. Some drug reps are incredibly honest, and you'll learn who they are. And then some, you'll sit back and go, you know, I'm never letting that guy in my office again, because I just don't trust him. And again, you'll meet them, you'll learn who they are. Electronics resources. I talked about rxlist.com before. Besides that, there's also one called MedicineNet. And then there's another one that I can't even write out, but let's see. This one is NHL for National NLM. Hang on, National Library of Medicine, NIH.gov/Medline. Right now, you guys are students, so you can get in it through the Lilly Library site without having to remember it. Drug information. .html. But anyhow. So there are a lot of places online. What else is available online? Wikipedia's got all kinds of information in it. eMedicine.com. WebMD. With some of these sites, what do you need to remember? Anybody can put anything on the web. It may be peer-reviewed, it may not be, for accuracy. So you just gotta be careful. Travis? UpToDate.com. We can try. But you can get the UpToDate.com that way? Okay. UpToDate. That's too easy to remember. So there are a lot of electronic resources out there. You can pull things up in a hurry.
With doing these off-label prescribing, should you use the name brand drug for that only due to the fact that's the one you're going to have tons of information on? And for the generic, you may not have that type of testing. You just know that it works for that case. And maybe it doesn't do as much like blood pressure reducing or whatever the other thing you're looking for is.
Okay. It's a great question, but it's not that simple. And the reason is most of the scientific studies are done with pure drug. Okay, so they're not working with formulated drug. So if you're looking at animal data or things like that, you know, how it's formulated is doesn't matter. The generic house has the same access to the synthesized chemical as, so it's probably all pretty much identical. If you're dealing with clinical trials, you have to look at the actual individual papers to see if they did the brand name or if they did a generic, and if they did the generic, where did it come from? Or did they obtain pure drug, formulate it themselves, and put it through the trials? Because that does happen. So it's not always simple. All right. Hey, you guys with ties to Lilly, any comments you want to make to share?
Yes. got up there and he's like, oh, I've been doing this off-label, use of it where I've seen all this great weight loss on these type 2, overweight, type 2 diabetics, and it's just, works wonderfully. And the CEO walks back up and he just has this big smile on his face. He said, oh, I didn't tell him to say any of that. He's like, So, I mean, obviously, the doctor was, pushing, for off-label use, but the company itself can actually say that, but they can have, people kind of run, their medical clinicians and stuff say that kind of stuff. You get the same effect as if they're saying it, right? So they send it to the same audience. So whenever I hear off-label, that's how I got introduced to the term off-label, was hearing that story. It kind of pops back in my head every time I hear it.
Okay, thank you. Any other questions? Okay, well, this will conclude basic principles. I had hoped to have the handout for tomorrow in hand. If it comes back from Maxi before PATH is out, I may show up in pathology with the handout so I don't have to bike over to the hospital with a backpack full of handouts. I want to save my back. Yeah. Mine doesn't heal as fast as yours does. Yes. No. Okay. The question was raised, what are we going to do?